Stuart Lipov is self-employed as president of his own firm, IP Action Partners Incorporated, which provides technology and management consulting services to stakeholders in the media, telecommunications, and the consumer electronics industry. Among his major accomplishments are leadership of several projects, including developing recommendations under contract to NAB and MSTV that were adopted by the FCC to mandate the phase-in of DTV tuners in consumer receivers. Mr. Lipov also worked previously as a broadcast engineer. He's one of us. He worked in Philadelphia and in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Stuart, big welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Keith, and good late afternoon, everyone. I'm mindful that I'm here between you and the dinner, and I'm going to do my best to keep everybody awake and hopefully entertained. I'm going to talk to you, by the way, I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me back again this year. This has really been a really interesting event, and I've enjoyed the presentations I've listened to up till now. I'm going to talk to you about a particular multi-channel video distribution service that is a little less well-known and popular, and it has some unique characteristics. As broadcasters, of course, you have this kind of multifaceted relationship with these guys because they carry your signals, but they also create more competition for eyeballs. And of course, they all have very different characteristics. Cable is the one that you're perhaps most familiar with, and I'm going to talk about cable in the context of this this new one, this fiber to the curb kind of system. Satellite has its own set of capabilities. There are a whole set of emerging single channel IP services that range from YouTube to Netflix to Hulu and new ones coming down the road, as you know, with HBO. And I'm going to mention one other that I'm not going to talk about, except to put it in context. That's Verizon's Fios service, which is kind of a hybrid between a cable service and a all IP-based service. They have different colors of light, wavelength division multiplexing, so they basically deliver broadcast channels over one of the colors, and they deliver IP, which includes video on demand over one of the other colors. Specifically, what I am going to talk about is sometimes called fiber to the cabinet, fiber to the node, fiber to the curb type of services. These are services which I'll show you the architecture on in just a minute, where it's fiber fairly close to the end subscriber, but then it goes a telephone line, a twisted pair the rest of the way. The commercial names under which things operate will depend on the particular cities you're in, because it's certainly not widely deployed. But AT&T is probably the oldest of these, introducing a service they called U-verse back in June of 2006. CenturyLink, who operates in Las Vegas and a variety of other areas, it's Sprint operated, has a service called Prism TV. It was introduced about 6 years later, 7 years later, I guess, 2013. Specifically, we did some field tests on behalf of a client up in Canada who's using, again, a service with the same architecture. It's offered by Bell Canada in Ontario and Quebec, and they call it Fibe, F-I-B-E TV. And that was introduced about 4 years after the AT&T U-verse. These are all exactly the same services. They use the same architecture, protocols, end-user equipment, and a variety of different variations of the service. The Bell Canada service we tested delivered both TV to the home and also delivered high-speed internet over the same circuit. And so what I'm going to talk about is, you can see from the title, is what happens when you vary the number of channels or programs, I should say, that you're watching on this circuit, how it affects the internet. Red, okay. I'm not colorblind. So the study objectives here were basically on behalf of a particular client who was in a dispute with Bell Canada over some of their advertising claims, which are that yes, you can get high-speed internet service and you can get unlimited number of television programs you can watch, and there'll be no interactions between them. And so what we actually were contracted to do was to do both a theoretical analysis that I'll present to you in the technology foundations, and then also do some field testing to validate that, in fact, the theory behind it were actually true, and I'll then show you the findings and conclusions. So here's a kind of a high-level kind of schematic of what we're talking about with these fiber-to-the-curb systems. You have video, which ends up getting compressed, and it's put down the same pipe in a digital form, encoded in IP packets, and they're mixing it with the high-speed data over the fiber, which has virtually unlimited bandwidth, fairly close to the end-user home, and then from the this node that's out there in the neighborhood, I'll talk about the distances in a moment, you then have twisted pair going the remainder of the way, over which you can deliver multiple high-definition, standard-definition channels, as well as high-speed internet, over what used to be just the regular telephone wiring. So with respect to the technology foundations, the basic point from the telephone central office to the home looks like this. I would kind of pencil in that where you see the cabinet there, the FTTC, the fiber to the cabinet, you can have multiple homes off of that. So that's typically less than 1,500 meters from the home. And where you happen to have a fairly dense area with a large number of homes per square mile, you can serve a lot of homes off of that area. So it's not a surprise that you find this sort of architecture really in more of the dense urban and dense suburban areas. Where you start to get out in the rural areas, this doesn't become practical because the whole point is to have a large number of homes off of this this cabinet within 1,500 feet or so of the home. The some of the nomenclature there. The DSLAM is a term that comes from DSL, digital subscriber line, and so it's a digital subscriber line access multiplexer is what it stands for. This is a figure from one of the standards for DSL. And the reason why first-generation DSL was very popular, started at fairly low data rates and is now accelerated to fairly high data rates, is the copper pair that's in the middle of this thing is a standard copper pair, that 22-gauge twisted pair wire that in the olden days would go all the way from the telephone company central office to the home. Today, in most architectures, it either goes to a cabinet that's in the neighborhood that may be fed by fiber, or it may be fed by twisted pair as well. But the difference is, you start off with a broadband network and a narrowband network. The narrowband network being conventional telephone lines, and what you can see is there's some filtering that occurs immediately. A high-pass filter that basically is a duplexer mixing with a low-pass filter that sticks this stuff over the copper pair, and we'll talk about the frequency spectrum here in a moment. And when it gets into the home, it's separated back out by the high-pass filter that goes and feeds the home network, providing the high-speed internet service. And the low-pass filter, especially in the first generation of DSL, actually there was no technology between there besides the filter. It just went directly to the telephone set. It was DC up to around 2 kilohertz. So a standard telephone set could sit on there, use a standard telephone home premises wiring, and there was no need to do anything in the home. This connection to the high-speed internet could be by wireless or could be by a cable. So when the first generation of DSL that was fairly low-speed began to clearly become inadequate, the industry started developing next generation of these standards, and they go by a variety of different names. The particular one that's used in the Bell 5 system and the AT&T U-verse and this sort of stuff is a standard called VDSL2. Very high-speed digital subscriber line, second generation. What's kind of notable up here is that there actually is a well-developed standard for it
G993.2, and I'll point out that it was issued in 2006, which was the first year that AT&T also deployed their network. So they were working on and contributing the standard to make this basically happen. What I have up here is the spectrum plan. This is what you actually see if you look on the twisted pair that's going from the cabinet to the home. And you can see the plain old telephone service, which goes DC to around 3 kilohertz down there. But then you have varieties, these different DSL standards. The newest one that we're talking about here is the VDSL2, and it actually occupies spectrum on the telephone line from 2.2 up to around 12 megahertz. So fortunately, it's not in any of the AM broadcast bands, although it's probably not doing much good to any shortwave that may still be on the air in that range. There were some earlier versions of DSL that are kind of shown up here that operate at lower frequencies and they have lower bandwidth, which I'll show you here in a moment. But what we're talking about is basically something that's trying to use telephone wires that were typically only designed to operate up to around 3 kilohertz, up in the 12 megahertz range. Another reason why it won't work in the rural areas you'll typically stick a loading coil in to these twisted pair in order to boost up the performance at the over long distances. But that has the effect of basically being a low-pass filter, and so it actually cuts off even more rapidly at these higher frequencies, up to 12 megahertz. So in the Bell implementation of this fiber-to-the-node system, which is the same, again, as AT&T and PrismLink, they keep the copper pair, the length of the copper pair, to less than 1,500 meters. Now, it turns out the standard that I showed you a little bit earlier, the ITU standard, allows you to go further than 1,500 meters, but as you do so, the bandwidth begins to call off. And as I'll show you in the next slide, by limiting the bandwidth to 1,500 meters, you're basically limiting the bandwidth of the home to around 25 megabits a second. So here's the 1,500 meters. This is the VDSL2, and you can see that it has a very steep knee in the curve. When you start getting above this, it's dropping off very rapidly in terms of its bandwidth. So it's kind of a sweet spot in that if you try and get it any closer to the home than 1,500, you have a lot more of these cabinets and the cost goes up. If you try and get it much further away, so you have less of these expensive fiber nodes, your bandwidth drops off very rapidly. This is a slide from an AT&T publication, which shows their vision of what the system is. They're basically looks very much like a conventional cable system up through their head end. They're identified here as a video hub center. They'll typically have some video on demand services there. They'll have some national super hub satellite downlinks for the network services, and they'll have either off-the-air pickup or generally a direct link to you broadcasters for carrying their signals as well. The difference here is that this is a switched service, unlike cable, which is capable of hundreds of simultaneous channels at the same time. The actual end link that ends up going into the home is limited in terms of the bandwidth that fits in this 25 megabit per second stream. How many different channels, how many different programs that can fit into that IP stream. Gets into the home, the first thing it does is it hits a gateway that ends up separating the telephone service, which is typically digital, that they're offering. So this differs from the first generation of DSL, where this is just an analog phone, it's a digital phone that they'll convert. They'll then have a PC here, or a network of PCs in the home. And I'm showing you one box here, which is a set-top box that ends up appearing on the TV. Looks very much to the end subscriber like a cable set-top box. You have a remote control, it hooks to their TV set. They can scroll through different menus. They can order video on demand programs, or they can look at broadcast channels. But when they actually select that, what they're doing is they're sending a signal back through the network to the switch. and the switch is actually switching that particular channel to the home. So it's not like you can have 25 VCRs in the home, each set to a separate channel, all recording things at the same time. You're limited in the total number of programs. That having been said, although it's not the subject of my talk, you typically will find in these installations, they'll have multiple set-top boxes. And within the home, these boxes are networked together. There's a VCR in one of the boxes, I'm sorry, a DVR in one of the boxes, and using the DLNA protocol, any one of these receivers within the home can access one of the other, the receiver that has a DVR in it. So they're capable of watching multiple channels at the same time in different homes, as well as recording on the DVR one channel while they're watching another. But they're limited in the total number of programs, as I'll show you here in a moment. So let me go through some of the underlying theory behind this that gave us a hint as to what we would find when we actually did the field testing. And I'll be a little bit of a spoiler here. I'm going to let you know that, in fact, the theory and the field testing did match up, which is really nice when that happens. Rarely, but it did. So starting doing a little reverse engineering, because they do not publish the details of how their system works, but they do talk about the end user experience. And so kind of working backwards from that and what they said, we made some computations here that I'll take you through. Starting with the normal 6 megahertz ATSC channel rate of 19.2, which, as you know, the cable systems, even though they use QAM modulation instead of ESB, at the upper layers, they operate the same using MPEG-2. And typically on cable, they'll allocate 12 megabits a second to two of these HD programs. So, you know, they're basically taking advantage of some statistical multiplexing in order to provide something that's at least medium definition, if not approaching the high definition that broadcasters are providing when they use a full channel for that purpose. Fibe TV uses advanced video coding, MPEG-4, which has about a 2-to-1 compression advantage over the MPEG-2 that's used in the ATSC standard and used by the cable operators. And they claim to providing the same sort of quality of video experience that the cable guys do. And so that would take them down into the estimated 6 megabits per second per HD program and 2 to 3 megabits per second per SD program. Again, depending on the amount of motion that's in the picture and the summing them together, what sort of statistical multiplexing or oversubscription they can do in order to fit that all into their channel. There is a desire to provide the same level of quality of service, same experience as the cable operators provide, where they have basically a dedicated frequency, a dedicated bandwidth of 6 megahertz on their channel, QAM modulated, and although there are impairments, as you know, that can cause impairments in a digital signal. It's an extremely robust signal that's in excess of 48 to 50 dB signal noise ratio and protected cable and this sort of thing. When you try and send the video over standard internet protocols, which you'd like to do in order to take advantage of all the technology that's well known and all the IP equipment that's out there without having to reinvent something, you run into an issue. The mainstream internet protocols are not really well designed for streaming services, for delay and sensitive services. You're trying to squeeze as much bits assigned to the video as you possibly can over a narrow pipe. And if you use a reliable protocol, such as transmission control protocol, the TCP/IP, that's transmission control protocol over IP, TCP has got the issue associated with it that it's a acknowledgement protocol. So every packet you send back an acknowledgement that says, I got it. And if the packet was an error for any one of a number of reasons, it's supposed to be resent. Well, that'll work fine if you have unlimited bandwidth, but the overhead associated with waiting to acknowledge it and then resending it would slow you down to the point where you couldn't be competitive in providing a large number of video programs to a home because people are going to have multiple outlets. They'll be watching the living room, the one or two of the bedrooms, the kitchen, wherever. The other protocol that's widely used for streaming is called UDP, which also operates over IP, but it's different than TCP in that it's a datagram type of protocol where there is no acknowledgement. You just throw the packet over the wall. It can be error checked. You can tell whether you got it or didn't get it, but if you didn't get it, it's gone. Unfortunately, just using UDP over IP is not going to be reliable enough to give you the high quality of service that matches what the cable guys are doing. So they come up with a really interesting idea. They stream the video into the home using UDP, but it does error checking. And if one of the rare packets happens to be in error, it sends a request back to the head end to have that packet resent using the TCP or acknowledgement protocol. So most of the packets are coming in UDP, and only a small number are coming in TCP, and that's sufficient to give you nearly the full throughput you would get with UDP, but still having the quality of service in an acknowledged protocol. So it's a rather clever engineering design to be able to do that. Now I want to talk about the methodology associated with the field test. So we had a rough idea that you could fit over this pipe 6 megabits per second that would be required for an HD signal and 2 to 3 for an SD signal. And the question is, what would happen when you were trying to both surf the internet at high speed in the home in the way that they promised, as well as be able to watch TV? What would the impacts be because you have just a single pipe where you're trying to carry that signal? So we looked at 5 households in both Quebec and Ontario. We had these households each arrange for a subscription to the Fibe TV service, which it turns out includes the Fibe 16 megabit per second internet service. You could take the internet separately, but if you wanted TV, you got the 16 megabit per second internet service as well. And the nature of the dispute was basically that they were advertising you got 16 megabits per second internet, when in fact, when you load the thing up with the total number of TV programs that they were also promising that you could be simultaneously watching, our calculation showed that it would actually begin to cut into the internet speed. In fact, it ended up doing it. To avoid any sort of criticism about some exogenous kinds of stuff, like something weird in their home network or something weird in terms of their computer having some software on it or running something that would end up interfere with the testing, we had a dedicated Clink computer that was doing nothing else other than measuring the internet speed, and we had a dedicated in-home network that was hooked directly to the gateway box being provided by Bell Canada. And what we did is we basically recorded the internet speeds versus the active video streams that were turned on and off. So of course, you know, this is a switch system, so if no set-top box was calling for video, the full bandwidth coming into the home was available for internet. As you turned on individual programs, you had to start using some of those bits for the programs, and you would expect to get some impact on the internet. We wanted to make sure we weren't running into some time of day or external network congestion problems, so we did the tests over a 7-day period, 3 times a day, day and night. We developed a baseline of what were the speeds with no television programs on, what happened when we turned on a 1 HD program, 2 HD, and as you'll see, some homes were close enough to the DSLAM that you could actually turn on 3 HDs. Some of them were right just a little bit past that 1,500 meter curve, and they were only capable of 2 HDs. Then we did a mix of 2 SDs plus 1 HD and 2 SDs plus 2 HDs, and we looked at the results we were getting, multiple data points over a significant period of time. Now, I hope you can see this. If not, I'll read some of this to you, and I apologize for the quality of this. But these were shots that we actually took in subscribers' homes of the diagnostic display on the set-top box. So you could put the set-top box in a diagnostic mode, and you can look and see what you're basically capable of based on that particular set-top box and the distance from the DSLAM. So over here on the left, what you can see is this particular one is capable of three HD streams. This one on the right was marginal for three HD streams. It's only capable of two HD streams. So there was some difference between almost half and half of the homes, which were limited to either three HD channels or two HD channels. Again, all trying to make this fit into the nominal 25 megabit per second bandwidth. As I mentioned, the in-home network was not something we looked at nor cared about, but it may be of interest to you because having the number of outlets in the home and the number of different programs that people can watch are probably also something of interest to you. Just peripherally, there is some information provided here as well. This is the in-home DLNA network that is between set-top boxes within the home. This particular one is capable of one SD and two HD programs that can be watched in different rooms, as was this one. The home networks were the same in both cases. Well, coming here really to the end, I want to show you what the conclusions were of the data we took, and this is basically reduced down to this level. So as I said, we started with a baseline where there were no programs activated. All the set-top boxes were shut down, and the only thing we were looking at was high-speed internet. And you can see the 25 megabit per second speed being the average of what we saw across all the homes, basically in line with the theory of what VDSL2 is capable of with a 1,500-meter spacing between the fiber node, the DSLAM, and the home. The expectation, as I indicated earlier, was that each HD would consume about 6 megabits per second from the that total 25 megabit per second stream coming down there. As you can kind of see here, that was the impact of what we saw. I'm just going to look at the mean here. The standard deviation was very low, which basically means that there are some adjustments to look at what the 95% probability of what you actually could do is, but it's virtually the same as a mean. So I'm just going to stay up here, but simply to say that because the standard deviation was very low, we had a very high confidence in the data. That meant that there was very little variation from one home to the other. So you almost pretty much can just look at the mean and look at the findings. But as you can see, when you turn on one HD program, you drop from 25.44 down to 19.62, or about a 6 megabit per second drop. You turn on two of them, you lose another 6 megabits per second. And what's interesting here is you can see this number 13 is below the 16 megabit per second advertised rate that Bell was advertising. So let me jump back for a second. What they were saying is you can watch multiple TV programs and you'll have high-speed internet. What kind of high-speed internet? You'll have 16 megabit per second high-speed internet. There was a little footnote on it, which is, yeah, you'll have 16 megabits per second high-speed internet, provided you're only watching one HD program or some combination of one or two SD programs. But as soon as you start lighting up more programs on that network, you immediately begin to drop below the promised, or let me say advertised. I want to be careful here in case there's any lawyers out there listening. At least what would be a reasonable expectation on the part of an end subscriber who would look at the advertising and would assume they're getting 16 megabit per second. So did I qualify that enough? I hope. If you're capable of lighting up three HDs, which they said, yeah, if you could do it, you could do it. You're now down to 8 megabits per second. Now, looking at something that might be more realistic, two HDs plus one SD, you can see that the difference between turning on an SD is about 2.7 megabits per second, somewhere between the 2 or 3 megabits per second that would be allocated to an MPEG-4 kind of channel. Turn on two HDs and two SDs, and you drop another about 2.5 megabits per second below the single SD. So again, each of the SDs are in fact complying with the theory of between 2 to 3 megabits per second for an SD channel, and about 6 megabits per second for their HD channel. They're calling them HD, but they're 720p channels, actually matching what the cable guys are doing. So that's the end of my presentation. I think I may have allowed enough time that you'll actually get to dinner on time. I'd be happy to answer any questions and hope you found this interesting.
We got it? Okay. I'm from Green Bay, where we have UVerse. And at first, they were not saying HD because they were not delivering HD. They were only delivering SD. And now, like you said, they are delivering 720p. Is that correct?
Well, yes.
Yes and no.
But I'm being fair to them in using their terminology. They call it HD.
So, right. And that theoretically, I guess if you do 720p, you can call it HD. It used to be 1080i would only be called HD. But I know of a couple. I have a brother-in-law, and my son has UVerse. And like when you put a Brewer game on, it is just horrible. The quality in the SD, it's got such high compression. I wouldn't watch that signal for 2 minutes. Did you run into that?
No, actually, there were a couple other details. We subscribe to some of the movie services for them, and I wanted the experience to be somewhat independent of the actual program material itself. And what I suspect you were probably running into, and this will especially be true for a sports broadcast, and every broadcaster here in this room, I think, will understand this. When you take a movie that's been shot in digital form, and you compress the hell out of it, and then you do motion compensation and fine-tuning and this sort of thing, you can deliver that over the same number of bits per second as, say, a sports program where you're doing real-time encoding, and the movie will just look terrific, and even though the sports program is coming in, you know, at the same megabits per second, it doesn't have all that fine-tuning and human touch-up.
Well, you get a lot of motion artifacts.
You'll have motion artifacts. You'll have a variety of other things. You'll have interference. You'll have dot crawl. You know, a variety of things that you end up going to have that would not show up on a movie that's been processed through, you know, a studio designed for commercial release. So, the program material we looked at in SD was really impressively clean. It looked as good as the best SD programming that you might see elsewhere.
Yeah,
but I think if we had looked at stuff that was being recoded real time, like maybe some ENG footage or something, or sporting event, we might have seen that there were some deficiencies in it. Because, you know, the MPEG is a statistical form of compression, and the more effort you put into correcting for the digital coding artifacts and improving the compression and fine-tuning it, the better it's going to look.
Yeah, a lot of that on UVerse, what I see is SD 480, and it's in a 16:9 aspect ratio. The same thing that Dish does. If you do some comparisons between Dish and Direct, which I have done, huge difference. Direct television is much better than Dish. I don't know if you other guys have looked at it, but yeah, it's the fact.
Yeah, and you know, satellite TV, Dish, Direct, and the cable guys basically share is they are dedicating a chunk of spectrum. specifically to delivering that program. They're using MPEG-2 compression, which, you know, is not as aggressive in terms of squeezing it down, and they don't have any co-channel interference, or they don't have any of these artifacts. They also are using very robust forward error correction techniques because they have that extra bandwidth and overhead. It's just the channel that you're delivering this over the DSL is really not anywhere near as robust. I should mention something else. When you look up on the pole at the cable that's running down the street that's providing your telephone service, you do not, in a dense urban area, you do not have a dedicated twisted pair of wires that's running all by itself, not in the vicinity of anything that's nearby. It's in a bundle. And one of the major impacts that occur when these things are running at 22 megabits a second, 22 megahertz over these cables in that frequency spectrum, is you have crosstalk between the cables. So you have a significant amount of interference, both near end and far end crosstalk, that's causing a lot of bit errors. So, you know, even though I'm showing you a 25 megabit per second raw rate, that's being reduced, in terms of total throughput, because you're losing packets that are being bit errored by this crosstalk that are coming through. So that's why they have to have this backup hybrid form of having, anytime they lose a packet, they go back and they request the missing one to be sent again using this TCP protocol. But part of the throughput they're going to get is somewhat dependent on how clean the wires are as well. If they're getting a lot of bit errors, they're going to be exchanging, less of the packets are going to come through UDP on ERR, they're going to be requesting more of them. So this was a fairly new neighborhoods that we were testing. The wires were in much better shape than they might be in some other neighborhoods in other cities. So it, you know, your performance varies.
Well, it's not uncommon to have a 500 pair of cable in the average older neighborhood, you know, compared to the newer ones. So I hadn't considered the crosstalk. I just think it's amazing what they're cramming down a twisted pair.
Well, you know, the bandwidth that you end up getting on twisted pair is flat up until the roll-off point, and then it rolls off as the square root of the frequency. So you could see from that slide I had up earlier, there's a very sharp knee of the curve. But the same thing within, your IP plant within your own networks. We started off with twisted pair carrying 10 megabits per second. It's been engineered for 100 megabits per second. Now we have 1 gigabit Ethernet over twisted pair, but you're limited in the total distance you can go. It's a low pass filter. The cutoff point keeps coming earlier the longer the length of the cable. So they keep it under 1500 meters and they get that 25 megabit per second. Comment, question?
Do you have any information or thoughts on the cost to the consumers? I'm an AT&T at home. I have a plain old POTS line and I get their U-verse DSL, but I can't get their US or their U-verse video, oddly enough. I pay about $87 a month for two of those. Now I know if I go add the video U-verse, it's gonna go up another 30, 40 bucks. Do you see that coming down at all?
Yeah, so there's two sides to the cost equation. Is what does it cost in capital equipment for the service provider to provision a home? And then there's what is the guy gonna pay for the service offering? So the fiber to the curb compared to cable in the areas where they've been competitive, they've been basically selling them for the same rates. So they'll have promotional rates. You sign up for the first year, you get a discount, you know, but when the dust settles and you're on a standard rate, they've kept them competitive. Now, what the actual capital investment is a little tricky because in both cable and fiber to the node are somewhat dependent on the household density. The more homes per square mile, the cheaper it is to basically provide the service. So in cable, you have, you know, a shared trunk cable running down, and the more subscribers you can put on that cable per linear, subscribers per linear mile, you're not going to be investing more in that trunk plant. In the case of the fiber to the curb, it's the more homes that are close to that, that are within 1,500 meters of that fiber cabinet, you're going to have a lower cost because those are the expensive parts of this. In general, to these fiber to the curb systems cost a lot more than cable, even though they're offering the same rate. And, you know, we, a couple of presentations earlier talking about some of the regulatory issues, but a lot of people complaining that the telephone companies who are offering these services competitive with cable are heavily subsidizing them because they have diminishing residential phone services, which they're charging for. They're making money off that, but they're making a lot of money off the business telephone services, which are not getting replaced by cellular. So they're, you know, the business services are heavily subsidizing their entry into these residential services. Some people have talked about Fios with respect to how much that actually costs per household in comparison to cable. So cable, if you have 75 homes per linear mile plan or that sort of thing, it's an investment of maybe about $10,000 a home. Fios in the same densities that cable is running on that order is probably about four or five times that, $50,000, $60,000 per home. So some people have called Fios financially irresponsible overspending, Verizon is very anxious to get into that. But you'll find that they only have that in some of the older cities where they have extremely high population densities per square mile, because even there it's four or five times the cost of competing with cable. And yet they're offering at the same rate. Now, they are providing telephone service and high-speed internet over it, just like the cable guys are doing. So they do have three revenue streams that they're going after. And as they're losing their conventional residential telephone service to new households where, you know, if you're under 30, you don't even have a landline phone, you just have a wireline, this is some way of preserving some of those additional revenue streams. They'll get some of that long-distance revenue from it. Well, thank you all, and enjoy the evening and dinner.